Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we have a great show. We have Rod Laurie has returning to the show. He was with us a couple of years ago to talk about Nothing But the Truth.
That's right, yeah.
He's a great guest, and it's an interesting conversation, probably about the most challenging film of his career to date, which is his remake of Straw Dogs, the controversial 1971 Sam Peckinpah movie starring Dustin Hoffman and Susan George. Before we play his interview, I wanted to kind of get a grasp of how you guys think about this. The notion of remaking a movie like Straw Dogs, some people say it's blasphemy because they consider Straw Dogs a classic that you shouldn't be touched, that nobody can kind of match Sam Peckinpah's unique vision, so why bother? How do you guys fall on it?
I don't agree. I don't think that it's a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination. I think it's a very good movie, but I think it's slightly flawed.
How do you think it's flawed?
I think that it goes on a little too long in its first half. The build up to things. I think that there's, it's kind of clear what's going on very early on, and I think that it just, I like Hoffman in it for sure, but I don't think that the villains are all that interestingly drawn, and I think the idea of resetting it in America is a good idea. I think that there could be some improvement on the relationship between the husband and wife in the movie, because I think that it's sort of one note kind of. It really, from the very beginning of Straw Dogs, it seems like she's just done with him, and I don't find that very satisfying. So, this is just a personal opinion. I think that it's a groundbreaking movie, and of course, in many ways, but I don't think that it's untouchable, and. I actually think that
The Untouchables has already been remade.
I think it's kind of an interesting choice to remake the film. I don't think that it's a movie that a lot of people have seen.
What comes to mind when you hear that Rod Laurie's the one that's behind the remake? Does that seem like an odd choice to you?
Well, I think that Rod Laurie he is a former film critic, so he is a film enthusiast, and I think that he's going to approach it with probably a good deal of respect. So I think it's probably a good choice.
Okay.
I don't know.
What thoughts come to your mind, Jerry?
What thoughts come to my mind? I do think I stand by it's Dustin Hoffman's best performance. I don't think I made a mistake when we interviewed Laurie a couple of years ago. He had referred to it as Lesser Peckinpah. I disagree with that. Do I think it's wrong to remake it? I honestly don't know. But I also know that it's not the end of the world that they did remake it. no, and I know, I mean this very much, because this is what I was talking about last night with some people. Not about just, you know, if you feel this strongly about it, there is an upside that more people will go seek out the original. That's always the upside, and I think that's good, and then they'll draw their own conclusions. You know, it's a Jane's Addiction album, nothing shocking, and it's very true that nothing is really that shocking anymore. Straw Dogs has made, this is going to be argument, is Straw Dogs today, this version, really any more, is it, can it create that shock value that seems to be missing in the age of the internet, in the age where basically everything is put on display, where there's no, nothing. I mean, there's no curtain. We burned the curtain down like in 1996, so you have no curtain anymore. Is it shocking? I think is the first thing. That's the thing I'm curious about.
Bonnie and Clyde, Straw Dogs, Clockwork Orange in succession ushered in the kind of the wave of new cinema violence.
Right,
and we've been inundated with it for the past 40 years since.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible to shock someone with that level of violence anymore?
Right.
I don't think so.
I mean, I think it's very disturbing to actually say that, but it's true though. But my thing is this though. All right, it's remade. There are some things I think that are untouchable, but it seems that's becoming less and less. True, everything is being remade now. Everything was, and this is, remakes are not new. People act as though there are, it's just a new thing, and it's been going on ever since really the dawn of motion pictures, really. So I'm just curious to see it. I'm curious to see his take. I'm always curious to see what would be someone's take on a Peckinpah film.
Uh-huh.
Because how do you get inside that? I mean, it's like, how do you get inside Kubrick? How do you get inside some of these, like, really visionary directors, you know, I mean, so that's I mean, Peckinpah's one thing. I'd be curious to see who the hell would try to remake Kubrick.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But that's what we're talking about. We're really talking about visionary directors with these larger-than-life personalities, and especially someone like Peckinpah. How do you, I mean, it's a daring thing to do. I mean, it takes real balls, I think, to do that. I think it takes real balls for Rod Laurie to say, oh, I'm going to remake a Sam Peckinpah film, even though no film in my, resume is anything like his films. I mean, you would never think him and all of a sudden, oh, Peckinpah. It's not the first person that comes to mind.
That's true.
I mean, he specialized. I mean, he made The Last Castle.
Yeah.
But generally, he specializes in political films.
Right.
There's a lot of sexual politics kind of embedded in the material of Straw Dogs.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's interesting stuff to be mined. I'll tell you what I think of the movie after the interview.
Okay.
Because I just got back from it.
Okay, all right.
But let me say that, I mean, we've heard it ourselves from emails and stuff and Facebook messages that some people aren't happy that this movie's being remade and that we're bringing Rod Laurie on the show to talk about it. We like Rod Laurie.
Yeah.
We think he's an intelligent guy and he's a great conversation. And I don't think remaking Straw Dogs is sacrilege. And I think if you really like Straw Dogs, the Peckinpah version, and you like it for the right reasons, then I think you can empathize with his reasons for wanting to do it. The source material is strong enough and interesting and kind of dangerous enough to carry several different points of view within it. And that's strong material. That material lasts and it has something to contribute, something to say. So, you know, think what you will. If you're inclined to see it, and maybe this interview will make you that way, motivate you to go see it, I would highly recommend you go see it because I would love to hear what people think of this movie. Because the audience I saw it with was not divided on it. I mean, they were cheering at the end.
So it's like a catharsis, like the original in one way. It's like a very cathartic, you would say, ending.
I wonder if people were cheering at the end of the first run of the original.
I have no idea.
I have a feeling that a lot of people were just stunned by it.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe at that time, I think Dean might have a point. But that's curious. It's curious that, I mean, I would be very interested to see this in a crowded theater, you know, Friday night or a Saturday night showing of this.
Do it. I mean, you'll hear cheers. Another argument is, you know, people are only going to know the Straw Dogs and not the one from Peckinpah. If you listen to this interview, that's impossible. Because half the time in this interview, we talk about Peckinpah.
Right.
So, Hafib, you'll have to be an idiot if you listen to this interview and you don't know there's an original out there. So here is Rod Laurie talking about Straw Dogs and how he brought it to life with his own unique bent. Here he is.
Hello, 911?
911, what's your emergency?
There are five men with guns outside.
What do you think?
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's been great growing up here.
We don't trust each other here. We don't even lock our doors.
I saw you in a picture wearing your cheerleading uniform.
You can take that out of storage for you if you want.
I'd like that.
I'm glad we came.
Fried pickles. Come on, baby.
No.
Mrs. Zoner. Charlie, put in a bid for me and my crew to rebuild that roof of yours.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Can you start tomorrow? A little early, don't you think?
That's the way we do things around here. You get used to it.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
All right.
Whoa! That ain't right, man.
That ain't right. I don't know what right is.
They were practically licking my body outside.
I can't just walk out there and accuse them.
You're a coward.
Okay, I'm firing tomorrow. Not only that.
How much they gonna pay us? Don't worry about it. We're all gonna get what we deserve.
Hey, Charlie, there is something in the Bible I do believe. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife.
What happens when thy neighbor's wife covets you?
Well, education's a very difficult thing to control, Harry. One thing...
There are five men with guns outside.
They're not going to come out, guys. So we have to get in.
If they get in this house, we're dead.
No! I've been aware of Peckinpah for, you know, most of my movie-going life. You know, I've been a movie fanatic, you know, since I was a little boy. And I think I remember the release of Straw Dogs, actually. I mean, I was too young to go and see it, and my parents didn't take me to go and see it. But I do remember, you know, it being a very controversial film. You know, even back then when I was just 9 years old, I would be reading reviews of movies that I couldn't see. And I remember reading the reviews of that film. And it was in the same time as The French Connection and Dirty Harry and I think A Clockwork Orange as well. And so there, you know, you had all these films sort of clustered together that were dealing with, you know, very violent subject matter. And it was pretty fascinating to me. But I don't think I actually saw Straw Dogs maybe until I was in college, and I was in charge. Actually, I remember very well. I was in charge of the what we call the Great Film Seminar, and you know, I was a cadet at West Point. Mm-hmm. And so I would bring in movies every Friday night for people to see, and the administration would counter me to show films that were appropriate, meaning that they were not controversial in the manner that, say, Straw Dogs was. And I remember the look of horror on the face of the generals as they sat in the audience during what I'm only going to refer to as the scene. And I got a nice little ass chewing after that was all done. And anyway, and then it didn't really enter my I saw the film a few times more, you know, after that over the years. And then and I remember when the Criterion Edition came out, I was curious about it and I watched it. But then a few years ago, my business partner, Mark Friedman, who had produced all but one of my films, came into my office and said, you know, I think we can get the rights to Straw Dogs. And what was happening is we were at ABC, the rights were at ABC Films, and the Weinsteins had it, Miramax had it. And and their option was running out. And I decided, along with Mark, that we should try to acquire the rights and then see what we wanted to do with it. Mm-hmm. And Because you know, I was very conscious of the fact that if I were to write and direct this film, that it would be preordained as a failure immediately. There would be a bullseye on my back. You know, who am I to redo Peckinpah? You know, I can't carry his jockstrap, and so on. One person wrote actually, Sam Peckinpah can make Rod Lurie cry just by talking to him. And so I knew all that was coming, but I went to a party, a Golden Globe party at Mike Medavoy's house, and there was Dustin Hoffman. And it was actually Hoffman who kind of talked me into it inadvertently when he was just talking to me about how that film is basically a Western. And he said, you know, Sam had his own ideas about human beings, and maybe you don't have those same ideas, and so just remake it your way. Tell the same story your way. So I thought that was pretty convincing, and so I went ahead and and did it. We then shopped it to the studios, and we ended up going to the studio that promised us the most tender, loving care and creative freedom, and that happened to be Screen Gems at Sony.
Mm-hmm. You know, the original Straw Dogs is a film that I admire greatly, but I'm not alone in saying that I grapple with its view of humanity. It's mm-hmm. almost saying that every man essentially is a beast, and it's just mm-hmm. a question of stripping away the facade.
Well, hold on, man. First of all, that's not fair to beasts because listen, man, think about it. No animal ever created crucifixion or the electric chair. No animal humiliates other animals. They don't hurt one another for pleasure. You know, Chris Rock once said about hunting. He said we're the only country that goes hunting on a full stomach. And you know, the truth is that what human beings are capable of, they're consciously capable of. Animals, they work by instinct, and they to survive and to eat and so on. And but you're very right about Peckinpah, because what Peckinpah not only was saying but said many times in interviews and in memos that he wrote while making Straw Dogs was that human beings are more or less genetically coded to violence, right? And he was a big fan, more than a fan. He was a follower of a man named Robert Ardrey, called him the only true prophet in the world today. And Ardrey had written many books, The Territorial Imperative, The Social Contract, African Genesis, that all seemed to buy into this theory that, you know, man is violent, and violent as a matter of coding. And so I grappled with that as well, and so did Pauline Kael. She just outright called the whole concept fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Dustin was talking about the notion of, you know, he had his own view of humanity, and you may not, Rod. That's exactly what he meant, because I'm like you. I don't have that view. I think people, if they're violent, are conditioned to violence. And so if there's a big difference in the two films, it's not an artistic one, because I can't compete on that level with him. He's one of the greatest artists of all time. But it is on a philosophical one, and that is that, you know, the characters in his movie are violent because that's simply the way they are. That is how they are conditioned. At the end of that film, Dustin Hoffman finds his inner animal, and, you know, for lack of a better term, my guy finds his inner man, meaning that he becomes violent at the end of the film only because he has to, not because it's a force within him that has to burst forth.
Hey there, Mrs. Sumner.
Saw you leaving. You bored with the sermon?
No, just not really my thing.
Can I give you a piece of friendly advice?
Sure.
Now, it's one thing to come into town thinking you're too good for the people to live here.
I don't know why you'd say that. I wouldn't...
But being too good for God, that's another thing entirely. You see, the pastor, he worked all week long writing that sermon. And then he's got to watch you get up and leave. Some people might call that rude.
Okay.
Just a little redneck wisdom for you.
Hey, Charlie, there is something in the Bible I do believe.
What was that, sir?
Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife.
Well, I believe in that, too. But what happens when the neighbor's wife covets you? What then?
When you were sitting down to write it, I want to know a little bit about your process as a writer. Mm. I mean, how much do you have in your head before you start to type it out, and how much is discovered in the process of writing?
Well, that's a question you have to ask on a film by film basis. You know, it's
right.
You know, I wrote a movie called The Contender over a weekend, and having no idea what the story or the subject matter even was. I just turned on the computer and wrote the words The Contender, and tried to find the story from there. At other times, I'll have a beginning and I'll have an ending, and I'll know where I want it to, and I know that I have to fill in the middle. That's what happened with a movie of mine called Nothing But the Truth.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of this film, actually, it's quite interesting. I wrote a very, very different screenplay than the one that audiences are going to see on September 16th. You know, I wrote a story that was quite a bit different from beginning to end, and with different characters and different resolutions. And I remember very well that Clint Culpepper, who runs Screen Gems, read it, loved it, thought it was great, but then told me, "Well, we're remaking Straw Dogs. You know, we're remaking this story." You know, and so I had a gigantic template for my screenplay. The question was, how do I now alter it in a way that will suffice to inform, you know, my theory of humanity and so on. Mm-hmm. Boy, that really sounds arrogant. The more I listen to myself, man, you know, it sounds like film school. It sounds like film school bullshit is what it sounds like. But the truth is, that really is the truth. And so you want to keep the film extremely entertaining, and but you want it to also say something. You know, very much in the spirit of say something like the original Straw Dogs, or like History of Violence or Eastern mm-hmm. Promises, mm-hmm. you know, Bonnie and Clyde, you know, movies that were very entertaining, and you never took your eyes off the screen, but also subliminally getting some sort of art message from the filmmaker.
Well, the film scandalized people because of its violence, and you know, we've been so inundated with violent imagery in the 40 years since and kind of numbed by it. How did you go about depicting the violent nature of that premise and to do it responsibly?
Well, you know what, give me that question another way. I'm not sure I actually follow you.
Well, I'll rephrase. As viewers of your films, I mean, I'm a great admirer of your film. This movie definitely seems to be a little outside of your comfort zone.
Let me ask you, have you seen the film yet?
I see it Wednesday night. That was the first screening that they had here. Yeah.
Okay, right, yeah. It's definitely it's definitely not outside my comfort zone, but it's outside what is perceived to be my sweet spot. And I'm very excited about that, actually. You know, I did make sort of an action film with The Last Castle mm-hmm. back in the turn of the century, but I was really excited to be able to do something in a way this overtly commercial and this audience pleasing. I have to tell you that, you know, I've gotten, you know, a fair amount of critical success over the years, and I've had some people take their shots at me, but mostly it's been good. I've been satisfied. But the satisfaction of being in a theater and having people going just, you know, fucking nuts at the end of the film is pretty amazing. I remember, you're probably too young to remember this, but or to have seen Fatal Attraction in theaters. But
I did,
You did. Well, at the end of that movie, remember, the audience is going absolutely, they're flipping out.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's happening at the end of our film. The audiences are flipping out, and I think that you probably will see that when you see the movie on Wednesday night. They're going apeshit, and I love it. And usually, you know, when I sit in the theater, I don't like it when people talk, but I do like it when they talk in my film, because when they're screaming at the screen to not go in that room, or to shoot him, or to, you know, or tell him, or, you know, whatever they're screaming at the screen, it means they're very involved in, you know, in the film. And I'll tell you, sweet spot or not, comfort zone or not, somehow it all managed to work out, I think.
Yeah. Well, I guess that was the direction of my question, because there's such a catharsis, kind of like the orgasm of the film occurs mm-hmm. when the character strikes back
mm-hmm. That's
through,
sure.
through violence.
Mm-hmm.
Were you comfortable with that dynamic, and how did you choose to portray violence?
Well, I wouldn't say that listen, it is a violent ending, but I wouldn't say that he's striking back through violence. He is standing up for himself in the only way that is possible at that point. You know, you will see that there's a running theme in the film of the Battle of Stalingrad, and that battle was probably the most important battle of the 20th century, maybe of all time, was fought not just by the Red Army, but also by, you know, the citizens, the women, the children of Stalingrad, using, you know, brooms and bricks and, you know, and stones and whatever they had at their, absolutely whatever they had at their disposal. And, you know, that's not insignificant, you know, and that's sort of what happens to our character at the end. He only uses what he has at his disposal to win this battle. He uses his brain because, you know, he's more invested in this because he's surviving. You know, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean, right, that he is therefore, you know, biologically inclined to violence, which was the suggestion that Peckinpah was making about Hoffman's character in the film.
Right, right. This had to have been a challenging film to cast because these characters are very, I mean, they're very challenging for the actor, and they feel right. a little dangerous, I would think.
Well, yes. I mean, the first danger, you look at them on a one-by-one basis. So you got James Marsden in a role that was played by one of the greatest actors in the history of movies.
Mm.
And, you know, that's obviously a challenge to him and obviously frightening to him. But, you know, I made a very conscious decision not to go after the actors that we thought were from the Dustin Hoffman school of acting.
Mm.
Right, we didn't go to that regular group of sort of the intellectually oriented actor that there's so many of actually today. You can see the influence of Hoffman's acting on so many different people. Instead, I went more to the sort of Robert Redford, Paul Newman school of actor. You know, somebody extremely comfortable in his own skin, very, obviously very good looking. And more, you know, if Hoffman was playing sort of a nebbishy New York intellectual, this guy is sort of like a Ivy League educated Greenwich Country Club sort of guy who makes it, even more difficult to like when he comes into this southern town with his beautiful blonde wife who was from that town.
Mm.
So, you know, that was a very specific decision. And Marsden didn't have as much load to carry as somebody from those Hoffman-alikes, would have been. Kate Bosworth, who plays Amy, obviously has some very difficult scenes to pull off in the film, and she does them absolutely beautifully. But, you know, it was very difficult to cast that role for Peckinpah. He was at first obviously looking for a name actor, but none would do it, and I thought we'd have the same problem. But I remember very well when Clint Culpepper, who runs Screen Gems, said that he wanted Kate to play the role. I said, well, she'll never do it, and because our history tells us that name actresses will not do this role. But he said, this actress, who he knows very well, he said, she's got a particularly high amount of courage inside of her.
Mm.
And so I thought, okay, well, let's give it a crack. And she was in more or less right away. I mean, we had, several hours of talking before she agreed to do it. But she, you know, in the end, she did it, and she did it beautifully. I think she does it absolutely beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And Skarsgård is the most interesting because, you know, that may be one of the toughest roles to cast because you're asking, you're asking an actor to do something that, not many men like to do on screen. And although I have to say when you look at Skarsgård on screen, I've never seen such sort of walking sexuality before. He is just brimming with it. It's like Brad Pitt in Thelma and Louise.
Yeah,
he was a guy that We had frankly heard that he had been testing for Thor, and you know that's how it sometimes works. You hear where people are testing, and for what movies that they're testing, and they become attractive to you because you know others are starting to see things in them. It begins to say something about where you're headed. And anyway, I met with him. I had seen him. I had never seen True Blood, but I saw him in something called Generation Kill, which was an HBO series. And when I met with Alexander, you know, when you meet him, he's not rugged, shall you say. He's very Swedish, and you know, he wore all this all white linen clothing, and he's had the very long blonde hair, and it was, you know, it wasn't the most aggressively masculine look that you could have. And so I was a little unnerved at first, but he assured me that he had what it took, and then we agreed to put him in, and we got him at a great bargain, and now he's one of the biggest stars in the world, or growing that way, certainly.
And that's another aspect of the film I wanted to discuss with you, is you've kind of changed up the culture clash in the film, because your film is set in the Deep South.
Right.
How knowledgeable were you about the Deep South? And
well, I've lived there. You know, I lived in Alabama, and I lived in Tennessee, and in Richmond. But let's say that you know, sort of Alabama and parts of Tennessee are about as deep as you can get into that culture. So I knew it pretty well. And by the way, I love the South, and I'm one day may live in the South. You know, I just think it's a beautiful part of our country. And I really like the people and so on. But one of the things that, first of all, sending it, there really was no point in sending it in England again. Although I did live in London for a little while, I'm really no expert on that culture back there at all. And don't think I could become accustomed to it. And that truly has been done. What I really liked about shooting it here was, A, it makes it much more relatable, not just to American audiences, but to international audiences, who have seen the South portrayed many, many ways and many times. So there is a certain comfort level there. Also, I think that that part of the world, that kind of town, which does exist, also fulfills this philosophy of conditioned violence, because it's a town where there's football and there's hunting and there's preachers talking about a violent, very pissed off God. There's bar fights. You know, it's violence is not that shocking down there. It doesn't mean everybody down there is violent, but it makes it a little bit easier to do when you see it as part of your everyday life. And so I thought that would be kind of interesting.
Was it a challenge, or not necessarily a challenge, but kind of a mandate of yours to humanize those characters in your film so they don't come across as just mere thugs?
Right. Well, I think that in particular, the character that Skarsgård plays is very humanized. And I'll tell you something else. It's the one area where I will brag, and I will tell you that I think that we topped the original film. I think that in the original film, it was hard to really digest what she saw in her old boyfriend in the first place. And that's something that has played out very well here. You understand the nature of their relationship very clearly. You understand what the attraction was from both to the other, and how they sort of completed one another. And so I think that was very important, and it obviously raises the stakes in our film quite a bit.
Yeah, because you're so obviously this is your baby. So you're about to give birth to this baby that you've nurtured for so long. I want to know, when you look at the film now, how does it compare to your dreams of it at the very beginning of this project?
Well, it's pretty darn close, and in some ways it exceeds it, because I never anticipated that the acting would be this good. I always knew that they were very good actors that I was hiring, but they're all playing at their highest levels. But it's an interesting thing you just said, that it's my baby. You know what? I'm going to say it's not really my baby. It really is Sam Peckinpah's baby. I have to give him credit for that. This story, you know, came from him. I might look at it this way, that he gave up his baby for adoption, and you know, it was, he was being, you know, raised by you know, somebody who is you know, a Redskins fan, and now he's being raised by a Cowboys fan. I mean, it's just a totally different, you know, being raised by a different father. That's all.
Mm-hmm. But it speaks to the strength of that material, in that it can hold these two different points of view equally well.
That's right, and that's what I think is that ultimately, Jamie, is what I think is so interesting about the film, is that both points of view can be held very tightly and can be told very persuasively, and that really is something about the underlying material. And you really could say the same thing about movies like Shane or High Noon, and
right.
You know, which were in fact the very westerns that Hoffman was talking about. You know, I showed this film at Columbia University, and somebody was making a comparison to Rio Bravo, which I think also makes a certain amount of sense if you know when you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you shown it to Hoffman?
No, I have not. I have not. That's a little too unnerving for me. But you know, it was funny. I was at an Oscar party, the last Oscars, and Hoffman was there. And I introduced him to Bosworth, and just extemporaneously, he says, "You know, you could play Susan George in the Susan George story."
Wow.
And wow, that's amazing. And then Marsden was at the same party, and I tried to bring Marsden over, and Jimmy didn't want to meet him because he was scared that maybe Hoffman would be angry at him. So I joked with him, and I said, "Hey, man, like, you're the only person on planet Earth that's worried about getting his ass kicked by Dustin Hoffman."
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Now, the good thing Feckenbaugh's not alive is maybe he'd want to kick my ass, although I think we'd have it out pretty well together.
Oh, I think you're a terrific filmmaker. And let me tell you, the Contender and Nothing But the Truth are my two favorite movies from those years that they came out.
Thank you very much. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, they mean a lot to me. I love them with all my heart.
I'm so anxious for Straw Dogs, and I congratulate you on it. And good luck. Best of luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
He's got some man in him after all.
My house. I will not allow violence against this house.
No, you can't.
Okay, that's Rod Laurie. Are we back on?
Yes, we are.
Yep.
Okay.
That was awesome. That was a really good interview. That was really insightful.
Yeah.
I like him.
Yeah.
So are you guys going to check this out this weekend?
Yeah, definitely.
I probably will. I need to catch up on a few other movies, too. So I'll probably spend the whole day in the movie theater this weekend.
Just sneaking from one to the other?
Yes.
I know many people that do that, and I'm always shocked that I was never, like, brave enough to try to do that. But, I mean, I've worked in a theater, you know, since I was 19 or so, but... you know, but I was always on the lookout for people that did that, but
right.
But people get away with it, apparently.
I've never done it. I always pay. You know, I can't. I just, you know.
And so I mean, you know, what can I say? You know, I'm just doing it for, you know, I don't do it that often, but it's just something, you know, that has to be done sometimes.
I agree. Yeah.
And if you pick the right theater, you know, it's easy to do.
Not that we're condoning.
Dean Treadway's how-to guide.
Yeah. Buddy, can you spare a movie? you should hold a sign.
Of all the years that I've worked, you know, promoting movies for completely for free and everything, I feel like I deserve it.
So I saw Straw Dogs tonight.
Okay, let's see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's hear.
And I'm really anxious for you guys to see it and the audience out there, too, because I'm not going to go into detail about it because it's a movie that is great to argue over and have a conversation about, the minutia of it.
Mm, right, right.
But I will say I kind of hated it.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't think it worked at all. But, I mean, the audience loved it, but I think the audience was responding to it and cheering it on because they just get off on bloodlust.
Right. Okay.
I didn't feel – I didn't understand any of the characters. I didn't understand where they were coming from. I didn't feel like their motivations were very clear.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just a question of ambiguity, which some of the ambiguity I'm fine with. I'm fine with the ambiguity that was carried over from the Peckinpah movie. Did she want it? You know, did it
right.
You know, fulfill something in her? The kind of the rape scene. I like the kind of volatile nature of that, and the kind of unknowable. It could go either way, kind of thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the characters do such strange things in this movie that seem so totally unmotivated.
Right, okay.
And it kind of doesn't it drops me out of the movie. And so I more and there are about a dozen instances of this throughout the movie.
That's an interesting observation.
Even in terms of blocking, there was some blocking that I thought was awkward and odd. And we could talk about these scenes after some of our listeners get a chance to see it themselves.
Okay.
But and there seemed to be a lot of things in the movie that were not developed, maybe alluded to,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't developed. And I thought that it could have been a much more visceral, relatable experience if these ideas were developed.
Mm-hmm.
What she saw in her high school sweetheart. What he fulfilled in her that was missing in her life, and vice versa. The whole subplot that might have existed with football players, high school, they're big stars, they got the prettiest girls in high school, they reach a certain age, they're losers, they're going nowhere. How does he feel about that?
Mm-hmm.
What does that ignite in him when she returns? It's all kind of alluded to, but it's not developed. It's not realized for me.
No, that's a missed opportunity there.
And there are several. They're very happy together. They're newlyweds.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't get a sense of a relationship there. And I think that Marsden's always been a very genial presence. And kind of like, I like him. But in a lot of stuff that I've seen him in, he kind of evaporates. Pauline Kael, she was bragging about Gene Wilder when she said this, but she said he's like mist on the lens or something. That's how I feel about Marsden, but it's not necessarily a compliment. I think he's competent, but not distinctive. So I was thinking this role, he could really reach a different potential with this role. And he does in moments, but I think he really overdoes the kind of brainy, constantly push my glasses up the bridge of my nose aspect of the character. And it feels false. I don't know what she sees in him. And there's some things that Skarsgård's character does that don't make much sense. The one thing that I didn't have a problem with, that the friend that I went with had a problem with, was the portrayal of the South. He thought, you know, it's Hollywood once again making fun of people that worship God
mm-hmm.
and hunt and watch football, you know. And I thought that it didn't down-talk that group of people and mm. those traditions. I thought it just portrayed it. I mean... If you go to the South, I mean, it's no different from watching something like Friday Night Lights. Football is their tradition, you know, football and church and in some towns in the Deep South. I thought it was an accurate portrayal, and I didn't think it denigrated those characters for those beliefs and traditions at all. And, you know, it was a necessary culture clash because he's out of his element in that world.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't think that was a fault of it. And I might have expected it to be, but I didn't find it to be. the thing that I love about it is the style of it. It's got this really lurid, feverish style, from the music to the jagged cutting, to the kind of the fast dolly zooms, and it's got this feel to it, and it reminded me all the way through it of the feeling of Scorsese's Cape Fear.
Oh, okay.
And then it turns up, I mean, one of the last scenes actually mirrors something that happens exactly in Cape Fear. So I said, maybe there's something to this. Maybe he actually was thinking of Cape Fear when he did this. So I'm interested to see if you guys see that similarity as well. But and that's it's a movie that I'm going to watch again, and probably again after that, because it's not a lot of movies make you question like Straw Dogs does. And I'm wondering, did I just miss something? I mean, did I miss the nuances? I mean, maybe these things were set up accurately, and I missed them. The things that I didn't find developed well enough. But I don't know. It didn't blow me away this first time watching it.
Okay. All right.
To my disappointment.
That's a fair assessment.
I mean, I could lie.
No, but I think it's interesting you bring up Cape Fear, because that's another case, I'm sure, at the time. I mean, the original is an awesome film, but I think one of Scorsese's stroke of genius is bringing Mitchum and Peck back into it. Giving it some connection to the past, and it's just you gotta let Scorsese can get away with that. Scorsese can get away with doing a remake of a movie that he loved and adding something new, a contemporary spin to it. So that's a good analogy to bring up Cape Fear.
I mean, Scorsese really brings an Old Testament to it. I mean, Scorsese brings depth to a potboiler. And Rod Laurie just brings a different point of view to it. Look, I'm fine with it having been made.
Right.
I'm fine with Rod Laurie having been the one to make it. I think it's worthwhile. For me, it just didn't work. But then again, the original didn't work for me either. Yeah.
Okay, that's definitely a fair thing to bring up. I mean.
And I don't understand the animosity. If the original is, you think the original is a classic, that's great. I'm not going to denigrate you or talk down upon you because you feel that way, and I don't.
Right.
I don't understand that mentality.
And it's all over the place. It's just all over the place. I don't get it either. I mean, it's not the end of the world. I mean, it's like, I think what I told you, or I was telling someone, we really want to make the rallying cry of your life, the remake of Straw Dogs. This is really what, this, of everything that's going on right now, this is the thing that's got you just.
why do I have to only like the movies that you feel are worthy? Why should we only talk about the movies that you endorse?
I agree with you 100%, dude. I agree with that so much.
We talked to the director of I Spit on Your Grave. I'm going to talk to the director of Straw Dogs and The Contender and Nothing But the Truth. I think he's a really strong writer filmmaker. I just didn't get into the groove of this one.
Right.
I just didn't get this one.
Right. No.
Not yet.
I gotcha.
But like Kubrick, I'm more than open to rewatching it and trying to see what am I not getting. And maybe it's there, like the Kubrick movies that I reevaluated, and I found it. I found the key for myself, so. I don't know. That's my take. I will say, though, Moneyball is phenomenal.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, me too.
Moneyball is a big crowd pleaser. And Brad Pitt is amazing. I was watching Moneyball, and I was thinking to myself, that's what a movie star can do for your movie. There's such, like, an effortless charm. There's the timing, the physicality, the confidence, the swagger. He's great. I mean, it's a great movie star performance, and I know people make fun of it, but a lot of people do. It reminded me of Tom Cruise and Jerry Maguire, because when I saw Jerry Maguire, I thought that's a perfect movie star vehicle for Tom Cruise. That brings out everything in Tom Cruise. Every reason why he's a movie star is in that
movie, Jerry Maguire.
I
wish
you do more movies like that. I liked him in Jerry Maguire. I actually like Jerry Maguire a lot. I mean, I haven't watched it in a long time, but I do wish he that was a really good performance on his part.
And the movie is very interesting, and he and Jonah Hill are great together. And it's very well written. Mm-hmm. I mean, Aaron Sorkin and Steve Zalian. You can tell the Sorkin influence in the dialogue. It's not as rapid pace as you know as a lot of his movies are.
Right.
It's very intelligent, insightful movie. It's not your typical sports movie in that it doesn't have the triumphant ending. I mean, and that's history for you. I mean, it's real life. They didn't win the World Series, so you're not going to get that movie. You're not going to get
right.
that ending.
Mm-hmm.
But when you guys see that comes out next Friday.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in discussing that with you guys.
Oh,
too.
Definitely. It looks. I mean, I'm really looking forward to. There are a couple here and there that I'm looking forward to, but that one's. I just something about Brad Pitt as he's gotten older. Not that I like the stuff he did before, but he has like you said, a movie star. There is something, and it is very exciting to watch that unfold because I really do like him. He's very likable and. He picks like the most interesting parts. He does not pick the standard. I mean, role. Just look at something like Jesse James or Tree of Life. I mean, it's just fascinating to watch what he wants to do. Battle, for that matter.
He's one of the rare movie stars that when they pick something, it automatically makes me want to see it. Because I think he has great taste, and I think he has tremendous sense of adventurousness, I guess. You know, he's always doing things that are surprising and chance taking.
And he stuck with this. I mean, this was in turnaround for a long time. I mean, Soderbergh had it, and then they had problems, and
mm-hmm.
Soderbergh reattached, and then he dropped out, and Bennett Miller picked it up, and it looked like for a long time that it wasn't going to happen, but
mm-hmm.
the one constant in that equation was Brad Pitt. I think he knew that this was a character he had to play. I mean, this was right up his alley. He knew what he could do with it, and it is a great performance. So I'm excited to hear what people think of it. I think that Brad Pitt has Oscar chances for it. Definitely, and I think that I think he's probably the only one. He and the screenplay, I think, will have Oscar love. Philip Seymour Hoffman's good, but he really has only three scenes that amount to much of anything,
mm-hmm.
and it's kind of a minor key performance. It's lived in. I mean, you believe he's the ball coach, but the role as written doesn't really. Go anywhere beyond he's the ball coach. He's weary. He doesn't like the direction the team is taking, but he has to stay there and put up with it. Yeah, that's
right.
His role.
Okay.
So it's a great movie. And then I see Dolphin Tale on Monday because we're interviewing the director of that. You know who the director of Dolphin Tale is?
But I don't know. I can't tell you right now, but I know it is someone.
It is Charles Martin Smith.
That's right. Yeah, I noticed that in the credits. Yeah, that's kind of fun. I think that movie kind of looks sort of sweet in
mm-hmm.
some ways.
Yeah, it's like this year's Secretariat, it seems like.
But not Secretary.
No, not Secretary.
Completely different movie there. Even though there is a tail in Secretary, but Charles Martin Smith is for those out there that don't know, he's a very recognizable character actor. When I think of him, I think immediately of The Untouchables and Starman.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I think of Terry the Toad in American Graffiti always.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So. That's right.
So he's been around a long time.
And then also Never Cry Wolf, which was
mm-hmm.
one of his rare lead performances.
His first movie he directed was Trick or Treat, the horror movie.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he went on to direct Air Bud.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And now Dolphin Tale. Is that like a 180 or what?
Yeah.
I
from the director of Trick or Treat, Air Bud.
Yeah, boy, he must be just taking the assignments when he can get them.
Yeah.
It's a long time in between those movies, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it takes a long time to get, movies off the ground.
Oh, yeah, it does.
I mean, if a movie with Soderbergh and Brad Pitt attached to it takes a long time to get financed and everything. A movie about a dolphin tail. Another thing about Straw Dogs, it doesn't investigate the male-female dynamic as well as it could. I mean, the sexual politics of it and the implications of that. How are they as a couple? How is he as a lover? There's a lot of stuff in there that wasn't mined. And plus, the lack of motivation even goes to the end of it, where all of a sudden he's sheepish and avoiding of any kind of violence whatsoever, and then all of a sudden he turns into MacGyver. And you never see, a transformation happening. And there's a revelation there's a revelation that is kept from him that I think would have completely solved that problem if it would not have been kept from him. Right. So we'll talk about it over the weekend, but I just wanted to point those out so you can remind me of it in case I forget.
All right.
Okay. What else is going on? Dean, anything you want to talk about before we close off with the last interview?
Scarlett Johansson's nude pictures.
Well, there's only two of them, right?
There's only two of them. There's the back and a little bit.
And I don't mean
front.
Her boobs. I mean the pictures. There's only two pictures.
I haven't. Yes. I've heard about this, but I haven't seen them, so I have no idea.
Well, if you've read the book, there's no reason to see the movie.
also, the impending remake. Another just on our subject of remakes, the impending announced remake of Point Break.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which seems completely ridiculous. Not because I love Point Break and think it can't, but it's just that movie just came out. Seems like it's
well, 20
why
years
not
ago.
Do a sequel?
25 years ago.
It was 91, right? 20
years
ago.
20 years
ago. Yes. Okay, but still, it's a movie that people go back to and take a look at. It's not a movie that's dead on the shelves. People buy it.
No, it's a very fun movie.
I think that's exactly why they're remaking it.
It's a fun movie.
Because it's still in the consciousness.
Great. It's about surfing. I love, there's some great lines in that movie. Look, they're going to remake everything, and they are, because I was talking to my brother about this, it's a name brand, first of all. It is a brand. It is some, has some life. But here's the other thing. We don't make movies for Americans anymore. We make them for the world.
And they haven't seen it.
Well, they might, but they have seen it, and that will around the world. Point Break, yeah, we've watched it. I've downloaded it illegally like 5 million times. But but that's what we're looking at. We're actually, and there is a major sea change going on. We're really because the Harry Potter, which I love, the last Harry Potter movie, and then you have the Transformers and Pirates of the Caribbean films. That those two. I don't even know if Harry Potter, how much that grossed here, but overseas it grows so much more. So it's like, I think now everything's going to be done, what's going to play around the world, not so much what plays here. So Point Break, they're probably thinking, oh my God, we can make billions with this. And I think that's what's happening. I think everything's going to be remade. I'd be curious to see how the Thing prequel, remake, or whatever you want to call it, does around the world. That's what we're really looking at.
I think it happened because sales were down on the Richard Nixon Halloween masks. The company that manufactures those masks really campaigned to get that movie made.
That's awesome. I'm glad
good
to see that will help the economy.
Did you read my comment on your post about the Point Break remake, Dean?
I don't remember.
I said sacrilege. They must have put baby in a corner.
Oh, man. Okay.
Come on. That's funny. You know that's funny.
Yeah.
No, it is.
All right. Well, We got some good programming coming up in the next couple of weeks. We have Joel Schumacher, Charles Martin Smith, and a couple of surprises coming up.
Cool.
I want to play one of these film scores. So can we play the Drive film score?
Oh yeah, definitely. Let me just find it though.
Are you playing the Drive film score because of Cliff Martinez? In your recent
faux pas, yes.
Uh-huh.
You know what I did, Jerry? I posted it on my Facebook, but did you read it? You know
yes,
what I did?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I saw that. That's an innocent mistake. I mean
our
it's
listeners
an honest
don't know.
Mistake. Who must get that all the time?
I was trying to tell Cliff Martinez on Twitter that Contagion's my favorite film score of the year so far. Like, great work. Great job, man. So I did that. But I actually had sent it to Clint Mansell, who is Aronofsky's composer.
Right, right.
And Clint Mansell wrote back and said, I'm glad you liked it, but it's not my film score. But I have no doubt that it's a fantastic score. I was like, oh, God, I felt so bad. I felt so embarrassed.
Right. No,
like, I'm a moron.
No, you're not. No, it happens to the best of us. I mean, I could see where you've made
I
that
get them
mistake.
Mixed up, too. I get them mixed up, too. Like, even when I see their names on posters, I'm like, okay, now is this Mansell or Martin? You know, it's just the similarity between their names is.
And then I posted that faux pas on Facebook, and then I got a comment that said, I represent Cliff Martinez. Do you want me to give him a message for you? Great. Anyway, Cliff Martinez is the composer of Contagion and Drive. Drive is coming out Friday, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yet another movie I need to see this weekend.
Yeah, yeah. And it promises to be a great, exciting movie from the reviews that I've read of it. And it's a good score, very good score. And here is one track of it. And when this score ends, we'll come back and I'll just introduce the next interview that runs about 15 minutes, and the show will be over at that point.
Okay. All right. Let me go ahead. I'm going to mute us and play this.
Okay, bud. score to Drive. That's a little piece of that score that opens up.
That was
up
good. That was really good.
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
I love that sort of retro sound to it. It sounds like, I mean, it totally sounds like something that maybe Giorgio Moroder or even Tangerine Dream or even as like Kraftwerk or something like that might have done
The
80s. Really, really good.
That the soundtrack is available now. You can follow the link on our on this show page, and it'll take you to Amazon where you can purchase it. Also, the link to the soundtrack to Warrior is there as well. We don't have time to play that film score clip tonight, but we will play it on our next show. That's a Mark Isham score and a very good movie.
Good score, great movie, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that movie will have legs? I mean, because it didn't have
I don't know. Jamie, this is a very difficult thing. I mean, if a movie like that needs the word of mouth, word of mouth is hard if you don't come out strong out of the gate, I've noticed. I mean, like something like Rise of the Planet of Apes had a lot of and The Help, but they came out pretty strong. But this is like has an uphill battle, I guess. But it really deserves to. I think people will like it because it's not your typical. It's a great sports. I was talking with someone earlier about it tonight. It's not your typical sports movie. It doesn't, if you watch the trailer, it doesn't unfold the way you expect it to, which I think is its greatest gift. Because if you watch the trailer, you're like, oh, wow, I know all these things. But it's the way those things are presented that I think is fascinating and really original. And they're just great performances. And just a really awe-inspiring movie.
I can tell you, my personally, that I had made the decision to stay away from it until I heard that it was good. Because of the marketing. Now, the marketing makes it, even the preview, makes it look like, you know, one of those, you know, like a cage fighter movie or something like that. And just the sort of gray kind of title, you know, Warrior. It's just kind of like I think I can probably miss that one. But
Well, and I was looking at the movie poster tonight too, and I said the same thing to my friend though. It almost reminds me of what Scorsese said about the Raging Bull poster. He's like, man, I don't blame anyone for not going to see it when it first came out. I mean, it's De Niro's face beaten to a bloody pulp in black and white in the poster. I mean, who's going to race out to see that on date night? And it reminded me of the same thing. But I'm surprised that it didn't open strong and it doesn't.
I thought it
on,
would.
On word of mouth, because the studio showed it to 17,000 people in the country in the weeks leading up to its release. I mean, they marketed it to generate word of mouth.
Yeah. There was an article last week on the Wrap basically that says, does Lionsgate know it has another Rocky on its hands? Like, they had implied that Lionsgate really didn't know how to market the movie. They had no idea what they had, and they really had like a good, you know, had a potentially like it could have been a gold mine. They just thought that they weren't doing it right at all. So it doesn't surprise me that it ended up like that, because there were ways that you could have done it. But 17,000 people, you said they showed it to?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
That's a lot.
That is.
They had promotional screenings, and then they had a Saturday night sneak preview for.
Yeah, that's right. They had a sneak preview. I know that.
They're doing the same with that I Don't Know How She Does It movie with Sarah Jessica Parker, which is getting decent notices, actually.
Really?
Isn't it to The Matador? Because it's got Kinnear and Brosnan in it. I thought, you know, is it a sequel to that? I mean,
right.
I'm joking.
Well,
I'm bad joking.
It's interesting. It got a decent mark in The Hollywood Reporter. They also liked Trespass, the Joel Schumacher movie.
Mm-hmm.
They liked Moneyball.
Mm-hmm.
They've been reviewing movies that are in Toronto now.
Right, okay.
A lot of them are coming out, those new reviews. And they say Coppola's latest is embarrassing. They say it's so amateur, it's embarrassing.
Yes, that has gotten some pretty round
really good to hear. Okay, wow.
They said it's almost like Coppola's career is happening in reverse.
He needs to make something big and meaty again. He really does. I know he doesn't want to, but that's what he really needs, to tackle something big.
Because Twixt is sounds like something that you'd make in the trailer, I mean, that he came out with.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like something a high schooler shot.
Right.
It seems like something that would be made at the beginning of your career, and The Godfather seems like a movie made by an older man, like an older, wizened director that's had 40 years of experience under his belt, and like a John Huston Pritzi's Honor, you know, that knows how to tell a story confidently and effortlessly. Yeah.
Right.
So that was an interesting observation. Actually, Coppola started in Corman movies, so, and it seems like he's returned to that in this new one, you know?
Hmm.
So we'll see. And there are moments in the movie that tell you to put on your 3D glasses. Like, there's a logo of 3D glasses that pops up on screen, and that's how you know to put them on for a couple of scenes. Yes.
Really?
Is The Godfather going to be in 3D now? I mean,
did I tell you about the 7 days in Utopia thing? Did I mention that on the show?
No, I don't. Well, if you did, I don't remember. So,
7 days in Utopia is the new Robert Duvall movie.
Oh.
And Lucas Black. It's like an inspirational golf kind of movie. Faith and family and golf and all the warm fuzzy stuff.
Right. Okay.
Apparently, a great movie. Like, apparently, audiences love it. Especially in this area where I live.
Mm-hmm.
It skews older. But the ending, it's this great, entertaining, nice, warm movie. The final golf match, the climactic scene, he swings the putt that will either win or lose him the tournament. He swings it, the ball starts rolling to the hole, and then the screen goes black. And it says something to the effect of, to find whether or not he won, visit www. I swear to God. That's how the movie ends. So, is that distasteful or what? That truly means that movie exists as an advertisement for a website that is selling you stuff.
Yeah,
because
they
sell golf paraphernalia and everything else on the website that they direct you to as well.
Wow. I just don't know what to say.
I'm stunned by this.
Yeah.
I'm stunned. I don't know what to say about this. It's just funny.
And especially when you make a movie that skews older.
Yeah, really. That's going to piss people off. I mean,
they don't go on the internet.
I don't approve.
I don't know what to say. I don't know really what to say.
I mean, that's the next step from, you know, 7-Eleven is selling a souvenir cup based on your movie, and McDonald's is, you know, fabricating a Happy Meal to tie in with it. That's the next step where you actually have to, you're directed to go someplace else to buy some shit and find out how your movie ends. You know?
Oh, my God.
I think it's a terrible bait and switch. I don't like it.
I mean, how many movies? Like, how many movies is this going to happen in? It's like, what if Schindler's List ended that way?
Fincher's girl with the dragon tattoo ends like that.
To find out if how many Jews, you know, were saved, visit Holocaust.org or something at the end of Schindler's List. You know, where does this stop?
Oh my God.
I
would expect it from, like, I don't know, like a comic booky kind of movie, like a Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is a great movie.
Oh, I
would have
been pissed off if that happened.
But you can expect it from that kind of movie that is being marketed to teens and young adults.
Yes, no, I understand that, yeah.
I don't think anybody is ever expecting that kind of thing from any movie that they would ever go and see, ever. I just don't think that it's the kind of thing that's going to engender a lot of people going, all right, let's go, we got to go home and get on the computer. I mean,
it's a gym.
It just thinks it's going to make people mad.
I mean, that's worse than enjoying the hell out of Mystic River and then it turns into a different movie at the end. Let's not get into that argument again. Hey, there's a great, fun creature movie out in theaters now, 1,500 theaters nationwide, and it's called Creature.
Mm.
Aptly titled.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The screenwriter of the film, Tracy Morse, is the interview we're going to close the show out with tonight. He tells us all about his views on the horror genre, his favorite horror movies, and the kind of disciplines you have to follow if you want to be a successful screenwriter of horror films.
Okay.
So that's the setup.
All right. Well, let me go ahead. All right. So we're playing this, and
we'll play it, mute us, and then we'll hang up or hang on the line. This is it.
All right. This is it. All right.
Okay. All right. So I'll talk to you on Sunday, maybe. All right.
All right.
All right. Cool, man. Thank you, Dean. All right.
All right. See you later.
All right,
bye.
Here we go.
Hey, and everybody, go see Straw Dogs because it's worthy of discussion, and I want to know what you guys think of it, and I want you guys to tell me I'm wrong and tell me why. I mean,
okay,
honestly.
Cool.
I'll be in the theater all day on Saturday.
Because
so
Rod Lurie, I think Rod Lurie's a great filmmaker, and I want to know what I'm missing here.
Okay. All right, fair enough.
All right, well, thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we're closing out with the creature interview. Enjoy.
Arms were like alligator skin, like claws.
This horrible, guttural, awful, screech sound.
Like legs and heads and blood.
Legend tells of a creature unlike anything we have ever known. An abomination that combines man with his fierce intellect. And the raw ferocity and killing instincts of the alligator.
A creature, half man, half alligator. Sounds like something dreamed up in a Hollywood studio. In fact, this particular story has caught the attention of the movie industry, and a new film, Creature, is being made based on this legend. But as you'll see, this may be one instance of art imitating life.
It's based off of a real instance that's been documented, actually going all the way back to the late 1800s.
It can only be described as mystical. It's not the kind of thing that you would normally find in any of the traditions attributed to the Loch Ness Monster or to the Bigfoot.
There's a story behind the monster. There's a mythology. Something that's rarely seen in monster movies as of late.
He is truly petrifying. He is one scary dude.
Scared her to death.
I found him early the next morning in pieces.
You can watch the movie to decide for yourself how much of the legend is just that.
Something just reached out of here and...
And how much is real.
He was killing mostly in defense. I think now he's killing for fun.
Don't see it alone.
Were horror movies, this genre of movies, were those a big influence on you when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. I've been, you know, a horror movie nerd since, I think the first scary movie I saw was Amityville Horror, and it, you know, it scared the poop out of me, and I've been hooked ever since, which is really funny because, you know, I write them, I've directed some, I've been a body in a few, but they're still the good ones, they still manage to scare me, so I love that, I love that roller coaster ride of fear. It still cracks me up that I can still jump in my seat even though I know exactly what's going to happen. So,
yeah,
I love it.
Yeah. But you never really considered filmmaking starting out, did you? Or a career in filmmaking, did you?
You know, I started out actually in rock and roll. Like, I'm from a family of musicians. And, you know, about 7 or 8 years ago, I started writing seriously and, you know, churning out screenplays and, you know, writing songs and writing movies. It's kind of worked out to be the same thing for me. But, you know, I pretty much stayed in horror just because, like in every song, there are some expected beats that need to happen to keep the action going. And it just really translates the same into, you know, writing genre films. You know what I mean? Like, for me, it's like there are no cliches in horror. There are expected beats that your audience wants, and that's what keeps them coming. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you've written a lot,
a lot of
screenplays, and so I want to know about the writing process for you. I mean, is it because for some people, writing is painful for them, and for others it's a complete joy. I mean, where do you fall in there?
You know, there are parts that, I despise rewriting. I hate it. I hate it because it's like, but it's just such a necessary thing to actually make anything better. I love writing. Like, I get an idea and it expands, and I love seeing the characters come to life. I love starting with, like with every good story, you need good characters. You need characters that you really care about, and characters that have some kind of, some backstory, some backbone. Because if you're not cheering for somebody, then, there's no point in watching a film. So I love the process of writing. I love writing in the scares. And I for the most part, I love to write stuff that I desperately want to go see. I don't think there's a project that I've ever put on paper that I wouldn't want to go see in the movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. You said that there are certain beats that that are expected in every horror film and script. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you more about that, but first of all, what are some a few perfect horror scripts that you find flawless and useful?
Well, I mean, what's really funny is that there's usually go back to the old ones. I mean, The Shining, The Exorcist, Alien, mm-hmm. Those three films. I mean, they're basically horror icons. The first Nightmare on Elm Street was absolutely brilliant. And then recently I saw a film called The Reef. I saw it last week. It's a little shark movie, which is so simple and so brilliant, and each character is so well defined and so underplayed that I challenge my friends. I'm like, if you don't think this is good as Jaws, I'll eat my own leg. And so far I haven't had eaten my leg, so I'm pretty excited about that. Because I'm kind of using it at this point, and I'd be in a lot of trouble with that.
You know, in the horror genre, you have your conventions,
mm-hmm.
and you refer to them as certain beats. But mm-hmm. And you're dealing with essentially a kids in the woods kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
So going from that basic premise, how did you set out to make it kind of uniquely your own from that?
Well, what's really funny about Lockjaw is that. I mean, Creature started out as Lockjaw. That was the name of the creature in the film. Mm-hmm. I wrote it way back in 2001. The original concept for the film started off where I was trying to come up with a place that had not been used in horror films, and I decided on a retirement home. And so originally the entire film was set in a retirement home with an old nurse and two sexy candy stripers. Of course, there had to be two sexy candy stripers, and they're dealing with, being stuck in a hurricane in Florida, and they meet this guy named Mr. Niles, who's badly burned and disfigured, and he sits in shadow. And it basically unravels this tale of these, and then it flashes back to, the 70s Vietnam, era of these kids about to go off to war, and they're having their last great blowout and heading down to Florida and having a great time, and it was really fun. It was really a different. It wasn't as big of a monster movie as it was a monster type personality, and it was really fun to use that that location, which was a little bit different. Then with the horrible rewriting process. I realized that it really wasn't very good. It was flashback and flashback and flashback and then going back to the old keep it simple stupid type thing. I modernized everything and basically just made it alligator tooth hillbilly chases sexy co-eds through the woods, which I could watch a billion times. And then at that point I was working as a below the line agent. I'm representing DPs, production designers, stylists, editors. And one of my clients was Fred Andrews, who's a ridiculously talented sculptor, painter, production designer, because there's nothing the guy can't do. He's absolutely a brilliant artist. And I tossed him Lockjaw. I'm like, hey, if you ever get to want to do a movie, he's like, are you kidding me? This is exactly the type of movie I want to do. And I think maybe a day after I gave him the original Lockjaw script, he had a sculpture of Lockjaw. I liked his marquettes, and they were absolutely beautiful. And then, like an idiot, I went and I got him a job. So we went off to do a couple of movies, and then ended up, you know, in TV for like 6 or 7 years, doing Without a Trace and CSI in Miami, and then about 3 or 4 years ago, he was off the shows, and you know, he re-upped my option of $1 for the Lockjaw script, and we went back and we looked at it, and decided that it was a little bit too simple. And I've always been fascinated with, I love stories like The Wicker Man and 2001 Maniacs, where there's a sort of a cultish type group that are kind of sick of feeding their own god, and they kind of want to, you know, bring in some, they want to outsource the feeding of their god. And we added that kind of element to the script. And after that, him and his wife Carrie, and they optioned it again and went off, and the film got made. They went and made it. So that's the whole genesis of it.
Well, that's another thing that impressed me about it. I was just having a conversation about this a couple of months ago with some friends of mine. It seems like the horror films of the 70s and the 80s, I mean, they were very good at creating these unforgettable villains, whether it be, Leatherface, Freddy Krueger,
sure.
Michael Myers.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't had a unique and original villain in a horror film in quite some time, I think. And,
no,
and yours,
no,
is,
I agree.
Yours is very unique, and the mythology surrounding it.
Well, the mythology for the creature stayed pretty much true to the original script. And then, I mean, Freddy is just, he is, you know, the guy is so well read, and he managed to throw in these Lovecraftian type themes to the creature and all that stuff, which were just, I thought they were brilliant. And there hasn't been a Pumpkinhead, and there hasn't been a Rawhead Rex, and there hasn't been those type of things for a long time, because, it's a special type of audience. You know, it's like, I have always been, you know, I love the guy in the rubber suit action. I love the Creature from the Black Lagoon. I love the giant rubber hand coming in to grab the girl in King Kong. Like, I love the tactile effects of films. It's kind of what I grew up on. It's kind of what I grew up loving. And I find it very hard sometimes in films these days to connect to the CGI creature. You know, I mean, like, you look at The Thing, I mean, all those fantastic effects and sculptures that were done in the original Thing, and you see the trailer for the new one, which, of course, I'm going to go see because I see everything, but you can already see the digital effects. You can already see the digital reimagining of these real tactile, you know, rubber and prosthetic type things that really made the movie so visceral. You know, I think a lot of modern horror lacks the real visceral element. You can even see digital blood. Like, come on. You know what I mean? Let's, like, just make it happen. And we were so lucky to work with Jerry Constantine, who is, you know, he studied under Savini. He is, like, he is a tactile, modern, you know, monster master. The guy is an amazing sculptor, and him and Freddie worked literally endlessly, and I don't know, consumed how much coffee they did to, like, you know, make the creature suit and the designs and all this stuff. Like, I love the tactileness of the film, and I really wish that would come back, not because of budget, but because of it's what the movie needs, you know, that's what the design is, and that's how it's realized. I think it's a really important thing that's missing from a lot of modern horror films.
I agree with you completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've directed your own films, obviously.
Yeah.
So when you live with a script, as long as you have Creature and work on it, how does it feel as a screenwriter to give it to someone else to kind of adopt and take over?
You know, I've learned it's very difficult, actually, and I've discovered that, you know, if you're making a choice to write and sell, you need to write and you need to sell, and you just need to, you got to move on. And yeah, for me, I've always used the analogy that for a writer, for a thing. Basically, making a film or writing a script is the closest a man can come to giving birth, right? You gestate this thing, you put it on paper, and then hopefully when it comes to life, it'll walk and you'll be happy with it. But even if it's, you know, if it's Jason, if it's a complete mongoloid with one eye, you're going to love it as much as you can and hope it does great up there in the world. You know, it's like, it's, and that's like, you just kind of got to let it go and hope for the best for it. And, you know, when I originally written just to be a, you know, straight little DVD, straight to DVD kind of monster mash, to get this like wide release and the being championed by the Scheinbergs and everyone, it's an amazing thing. And to see the people just cheering and just actually getting it in the theater, that's, you know, I mean, that's brilliant. You know, I could not be more tickled. It's fantastic.
And, you know, it's something special with horror movies. I think the only other kind of movie like them are comedies, in that the audience, if you watch it with an audience, I mean, that gives the movie a whole other dimension. I mean, it's infectious.
Of course. Yeah. No, and it's catching as well. I mean, like, if you know, one person screams, someone else is going to scream, or a laugh will, you know, bring a laugh. But the fans, and I've been a horror movie fan my entire life, is like, there's not too many romantic comedy conventions, you know. There's not too many, you know, there's not too many, let's go to the Hangover convention. Oh, yeah, there's all those people at that Hangover convention. Horror movie fans are the most dedicated and ravenous fans, I think, in the world. And in a lot of ways, a lot of the films are critic-proof, but so long as the fans are happy and the fans get what they want, it really doesn't matter. You know, and it's like that, most of the stuff that I write for me because I'm a fan and this is stuff that I want to see. Yes, I want to see the creature tear somebody apart and I want this to happen and all the other stuff. But to watch it with your peers, with the fans that you love and that you're part of, that makes you happy. Like that's the, that's really the good stuff. When the popcorn flies and you're there, it's a good time.
So when you see the movie, I mean, how do you think it holds up to your original vision of it?
Well, there's quite a few changes that Freddie made and the producers made, on the fly. Every single character is there. I think they couldn't have done a better job with casting. The casting is amazing, just like really right to the page. And to have, you know, Sid Haig be Chopper, which is, you know, is one of my heroes. That guy is just such a presence and such a force. I mean, it's amazing. It's really amazing.
There ain't none set against playing with him. Is there?
What do you mean?
I mean, we're supposed to make sure that they don't go nowhere. So if we with them, huh?
Well, that's what you're thinking there. I mean, are we supposed to keep an eye on them?
Huh?
I'm supposing that'd be a fine way, I reckon. I mean, and if we're supposed to be watching them, and then we be...
Why can't we play, huh?
Why can't we play?
Why can't we play?
Why can't we play?
Why can't we play? Hmm?